From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Deadly rocket attack in eastern Ukraine blamed on Russian-backed rebels. U.S. lawmakers express doubts about Iran nuclear talks. An election shock in India. And computer skills find a home in a most unexpected place. We'll take you there. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. President Obama spoke by phone Tuesday with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, urging him to back a peace deal for Ukraine set for review at a foreign nation crisis summit in Belarus. Mr. Obama is said to have underscored the rising human toll of the fighting, as well as the importance of Mr. Putin seizing the opportunity to back peace proposals when he meets today with the leaders of France, Germany, and Ukraine in Minsk. Ukraine reports that rocket strikes in the eastern city of Kramatorsk killed at least 12 people and wounded more than 80 others Tuesday. The foreign ministry blames pro-Russian separatists for this latest violence, calling the rocket barrage a deliberate massacre of the city's civilians. VOA's Daniel Sharp witnessed the aftermath of the onslaught.
Ukrainian security forces tell people to move back after a rocket landed in this residential neighborhood but failed to detonate. Other areas of the city were not so lucky and suffered casualties, civilians and soldiers. Deputy Chief of the Donetsk Region Police, Lieutenant Colonel Kiva Ilya, tells VOA about 20 rockets hit Kramatorsk, including cluster bombs. But he says nearly half of them did not explode.
My nation is being destroyed here. Ukrainian people, civilians. The Russian Federation is doing the destroying. War is here. That's what happened.
Kramatorsk is the headquarters for Ukraine's military as it struggles to fend off Russia-backed rebels moving in from the east. The military's airport was also hit, underscoring its vulnerability. In another rocket-damaged residential area, Vanya says he came home to find his 12-year-old son laying in the bathroom, crying and shaking.
I was sitting, playing on my computer. Then I heard one explosion. I ran into my bathroom and hid there, and the shells started to fall down. I heard windows blow out. I called to my parents.
The town was taken by the rebels once before, and some here lean more to Moscow than to Kiev. Regardless of loyalty, ordinary people want the fighting to stop, and some are moving further away to avoid the violence, like Miroslava.
Now I'm returning to pack my stuff to leave.
Will you leave Kramatorsk?
Of course. I'm afraid for my child. Thank you very much. I'm sorry.
Daniel Sheriff, VOA News, Kramatorsk, Ukraine.
Since pro-Russia rebels in eastern Ukraine seized government buildings 10 months ago, 5,400 people have been killed and more than 1 million displaced. U.S. officials have confirmed that an American woman held hostage by Islamic State militants in Syria is dead. They made the announcement Tuesday, 4 days after the IS group claimed that 26-year-old aid worker Kayla Muller was killed in an airstrike by Jordanian warplanes serving in a U.S.-led coalition. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says U.S. intelligence analysts have not determined when or how the woman died after being kidnapped in Syria in August of 2013. But he says there was no evidence of the claim by the Islamic State that a Jordanian airstrike killed her.
What is not possible to call into question is that ISIL, regardless of her cause of death, is responsible for it. This, after all, is the organization that was holding her against her will. That means they are responsible for her safety and her well-being, and they are therefore responsible for her death.
Earlier Tuesday, a U.S. National Security Council spokesperson said Ms. Mueller's family received a private message from her captors in recent days with information that corroborated news of her death. The number of foreign fighters traveling to Syria and Iraq to join the Islamic State or other extremist groups continues to rise despite months of bombardment by the U.S. and its allies. U.S. counterterrorism officials plan to tell the House Homeland Security Committee today that more than 20,000 foreign fighters, including more than 150 from the U.S. and more than 90 other countries, have gone to the region. The U.S. embassy in Yemen is closing due to deteriorating security conditions since the resignation of the country's president. A U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity confirmed Tuesday an earlier statement by Yemeni employees at the embassy in Sana'a. U.S. lawmakers of both major political parties are expressing growing skepticism that international negotiations with Iran will yield an accord that prevents it from building a nuclear weapon. The comments come as Washington and Tehran suggest there will be no further extension of nuclear talks that began after an interim accord reached in 2013. VOA's Michael Bowman has more.
One day after President Barack Obama said the time has come for Iran to decide on its nuclear program, members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee met behind closed doors to hear from unnamed administration officials on the status of the talks and what exactly the United States knows about Iran's current nuclear capabilities. Committee Chairman Bob Corker, a Republican, emerged to make a somber assessment.
We really are in a position of managing proliferation now with the country of Iran.
The committee's top Democrat, Senator Robert Menendez, echoed the concern, noting the United States is aiming to make sure Iran would need a one-year breakout period to build a nuclear weapon if an accord falters.
Instead of preventing proliferation, we are managing proliferation. If we enter a new world order and where we are going to manage proliferation, where in fact a country could be a year away from the possibility of breaking out nuclear capabilities for nuclear weapons, that's a different world and a far more challenging world.
Corker said he does want a negotiated settlement on Iran's nuclear program, but he repeatedly expressed concerns that an accord might be weak on nuclear restrictions while providing Iran with a massive economic boost when international sanctions are lifted. Some Republican lawmakers, like Senator Marco Rubio, want to craft new economic sanctions against Tehran, despite administration warnings that such measures would torpedo negotiations.
I do believe we should have sanctions in place that would kick in when these talks fail, as I unfortunately believe they will.
Several Democrats declined to comment after emerging from the hearing, saying they could not discuss classified matters. The current negotiating round ends in June, but participants are aiming to hammer out the framework for an accord by next month. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Witnesses in central Somalia say at least 12 people were killed and 30 others wounded on Tuesday when a moderate Islamist group clashed with Somali government troops. The clash has occurred about 400 kilometers north of the capital, Mogadishu. The U.S. Defense Department confirms that it killed senior al-Shabaab militant leader Yusuf Deeg and one of his associates in a January 31st drone strike. Deeg's death already had been reported to VOA by the militant group and the Somali government, which said the militant was al-Shabaab's chief of external operations, responsible for planning attacks inside and outside Somalia. A new United Nations report finds Libya facing turmoil, lawlessness, and armed conflict. The findings by the UN Human Rights Office and the UN support mission in Libya will be formally presented to the Human Rights Council next month. Lisa Schlein has details.
The report dashes any lingering hope the Arab Spring would result in Libya's becoming a democratic, egalitarian nation. It paints a bleak picture of a society run by several armed factions determined to exert their power not by rule of law, but of the gun. Report authors say Libya is facing the worst political crisis and escalation of violence since the 2011 armed conflict that toppled long-reigning dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says civilians last year were victims of indiscriminate artillery and air attacks. He says unlawful killings and summary executions, including targeted assassinations, were commonplace.
Footage appearing to show a number of beheadings in Benghazi and Derna emerged in November. and a number of hospitals, schools, as well as airports and other public infrastructure were attacked and damaged or used for military purposes. Children have suffered tremendously, with large numbers unable to go to school in their hometowns, and some killed or maimed at home or during attacks on schools and hospitals.
The report documents a wide range of gross violations of human rights committed by all armed factions. These include harassment, intimidation, torture, abductions, and summary executions. It notes human rights defenders, journalists, members of the judiciary, and politicians are among those specifically targeted for abuse. The UN report describes numerous incidents of violence against women, minority groups, and Egyptian Coptic Christians during the past year. It highlights the extremely vulnerable situation of migrants and internally displaced people in Libya. It says thousands of people are in detention, with many subject to torture or other ill treatment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The number of deaths from Ebola is now more than 9,150. A sharp increase following weeks in which the outbreak appeared to be weakening. The death toll reported Tuesday by the World Health Organization represents a jump of almost 150 deaths since the agency's last update 3 days earlier. The highest number of new cases are reported in Liberia, followed by Sierra Leone and Guinea. UN Special Envoy on Ebola, Dr. David Nabarro, says the new numbers show the outbreak is not yet under control.
Good progress is being made, but the outbreak still presents a grave threat, and we really hope that there will be no complacency among anybody involved in the response. We have to really work hard to get to what we call zero cases and zero transmission.
The WHO says there is an urgent need to end the outbreak before the wet season begins and access to remote areas becomes more difficult. Italian authorities say at least 29 African migrants have died of hypothermia while crossing the Mediterranean in freezing weather and rough seas. The Italian Coast Guard says all the victims were men from sub-Saharan Africa. Another 76 migrants survived the journey, which began on a tightly packed inflatable boat. A surprise in India politics. The ruling Bharatiya Janata Party was routed in local elections held in New Delhi by a young party known for its strong anti-corruption plank. It is the first election loss for the BJP since last year's huge victory. Anjana Pasricha reports.
The scale of the defeat for the Bharatiya Janata Party was far worse than expected, with the Aam Aadmi or Common Man's Party set to control more than 90% of the seats in the 70-member Delhi Assembly. Prime Minister Modi conceded defeat early and promised to support Aam Aadmi Party chief Arvind Kejriwal. The two-year-old Aam Aadmi Party rode to power on a plank of rooting out corruption, providing cheaper water, electricity and clean governance. Elections were held in Delhi because polls a year ago produced no clear winner. At that time, the BJP had emerged as the number one party. Its massive slide since is seen as a blow for Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who appeared politically invincible after he consolidated last year's stunning victory in national elections with a string of successes in state polls. Political commentators say the larger-than-life image is now dented and termed it a wake-up call for the BJP. It was a dramatic comeback for the Aam Aadmi Party. Arvind Kejriwal, the party's leader and an anti-corruption activist, has pledged to clean up Indian politics. He resigned following a brief 49-day rule in Delhi last year. The party was later routed in national elections and was dismissed by many commentators as inexperienced. Now, Kejriwal is poised to return as Chief Minister of Delhi for a second term, this time with a massive party majority in the Delhi Assembly. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The Delhi results have little direct impact on national politics, but they get disproportionate attention because New Delhi is a seat of national government. A measles outbreak in the United States, which started in California, has now spread to 16 other states and Washington, D.C. The highly contagious disease is affecting more than 120 people. Health officials say vaccines eliminated measles in the U.S. back in the year 2000, a big improvement from the past, which saw hundreds of thousands of cases and hundreds of deaths annually. But some parents are refusing to vaccinate their children, and that is believed to be part of the reason for the measles return. Elizabeth Lee explains.
Sandy Rothman is not vaccinating her daughter, Brooklyn, but not by choice.
We were told that she was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which requires 2 years of very, very heavy chemotherapy,
which completely wipes out her immune system. All vaccinations for her had to be suspended.
I feel incensed that there are people out there who are deliberately exposing their children to other illnesses. I have spent the last 2.5 years of my life with a chronically ill child, and it's unfathomable to me that anyone would deliberately put their child in harm, and B, would put the rest of the world at harm.
Rothman is referring to parents who choose not to vaccinate their children. Public Health Officer Eric Handler says a measles outbreak that originated in Disneyland has now spread. In Orange County alone, more than 30 people have contracted measles, and a third of them are children.
The children, the majority were not vaccinated.
Handler says some parents are afraid their children will get autism from vaccines, something that's been disproven in the medical community. He points to the internet as the source of much of the fears among parents. Parents like Dottie Hagmeyer, who don't vaccinate their children, say they are acting in the child's best interest.
There's also many risks if they get the vaccine versus getting an illness that they could actually recover from.
They are making a decision not to vaccinate based on information that they get from the internet and from their peers. And we see pockets of affluent areas choosing to not get vaccinated. But this is not unique to Orange County.
In California, students are required to be vaccinated when they enter school, but parents who don't vaccinate their children can get a waiver called a personal belief exemption. State records show in child care facilities of 2 to 4 year olds, there are more personal belief exemptions in private schools than public schools. Sandy Rothman wanted to enroll her daughter in a school that specialized in art, but didn't because of the number of unvaccinated children there.
We're talking about children of educated artists attending this school has an 11% personal belief exemption. This is the school that we want to send our child to, but we can't.
But there has been a slight decrease in the number of personal belief exemptions in California schools. Public Health Officer Handler attributes that to a state law enacted last year that requires parents to talk to a healthcare provider who has to sign off on the waiver. He stresses it is in the best interest of the child and the community to vaccinate children. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Katy Perry, Beyonce, Adele, Taylor Swift, just a few of the music celebrities we've interviewed on Border Crossings. Weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA Music Mix. I'm Larry London. We also play your requests and have great prizes to give away. Join us for Border Crossings Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA Music Mix.
NBC television news anchor Brian Williams is being suspended for 6 months without pay for embellishing his role in an Iraq war story. Williams, who has issued a public apology for his actions, has been the subject of an internal NBC investigation. Last week, he announced he would be removing himself from his top-rated evening national newscast for several days. In announcing the suspension, NBC Universal Chief Executive Steve Burke said Williams jeopardized the trust millions of Americans place in NBC News and that his actions are inexcusable. The NBC chief did not say whether Williams would return to his news anchor position after the suspension. It's never too late to learn computer skills, even if you are behind bars. Only 32 kilometers separate San Quentin State Prison from the affluent San Francisco Bay Area. For most prisoners, the gap between them and the city's high-tech world seems insurmountable, until now. That's because some of them are learning computer coding. Joanne Marr visited San Quentin's coding boot camp to find out more.
Okay, so starting with a simple web page, just an HTML tag and a closing HTML tag.
18 prisoners are sitting in front of computer screens, listening intently to their instructor via a video conference hookup. This is code 7370, the new computer coding class that started last year at San Quentin.
Bingo. Here we go. And then we push Control Save, and it should come back refresh.
Gary Valentino Hollis is learning to construct a basic web page using JavaScript, HTML, and CSS. He was convicted of attempted murder in the 1990s, and he's been in prison for the last 20 years. He'll be graduating from the coding class in April, just in time for his release from San Quentin.
Oh, my God. This is truly an honor and a blessing to be in this type of setting, especially here in prison. This is a million-dollar dream because it gives a lot of men hope, such as myself. Getting out in about 108 days, but who's counting? Getting out, I know I have a skill now that I can market to provide the means for my family and to be a productive citizen than I was 20-some years ago. You know, everyone deserves a new chance. So this is my new chance, my new way of life.
The prison coding class was started by The Last Mile, a San Francisco nonprofit founded by tech industry veterans Chris Redlitz and Beverly Parenti. On his first visit to San Quentin, Redlitz came up with the idea of giving prisoners marketable skills to help them reenter society when they get out.
And my first reaction was, are you kidding me? And that's not actually what I said, but I don't think I'll say that on the radio.
At first, Beverly Parenti called it one of Chris's crazy ideas.
And then I actually went in and met some of the men and talked to them and learned their stories and saw their passion and enthusiasm and intelligence, and I quickly agreed that I would help Chris launch The Last Mile inside San Quentin, which was not an easy task, but we were determined, and we didn't take no for an answer. We took no as a kind of a way to work harder. And so we basically had a startup of our own inside San Quentin, and that's the beginning of The Last Mile.
The first problem was lack of internet access. U.S. prisons do not allow inmates to get online. So Redlitz turned to the coding school, Hack Reactor, and they developed a program that does not require connectivity. Hack Reactor provides volunteer instructors who broadcast lessons into the classroom from a remote location. The second problem, when the program finally began last year, half the prisoners taking the course had no computer experience. For Gary Valentino Hollis, coding was like learning a foreign language.
I mean, I don't even know how to turn it on a telephone. I don't even have a clue what an app is or how to turn it on. There's times I feel very, very frustrated. But the give up part is not in the blood. There's not one guy in here that has that on their mind and giving up. We all work as a team. The thing is, see on the wall up here, they got, it says believe in the process, and that's what it's about. Believing in the process, and that's keep working, and eventually clicks.
The class is an intense 6-month course. Prisoners spend 10 hours a day, 4 days a week, learning coding language. The Last Mile has a zero tolerance policy. If students miss class or misbehave, they are immediately terminated. Chris Redlitz says he has high hopes for all of them.
You know, the opportunities are huge, especially in this industry. You know, if you can write great code, people really don't care much about your background. It really, I think, resolves a lot of issues that we've had in the past where, you know, it's sort of checking the box, right? I'm an ex-felon and I don't qualify for the job. In this particular industry, it doesn't matter. Just write great code and you've got a job.
When these prisoners graduate from the course and finish their sentences, they'll have completed the last mile. Chances are good they won't return to prison when they find good-paying jobs. Chris Redlitz and Beverly Parenti hope to expand the Last Mile program and bring it to other prisons in California and the West Coast. For VOA News, I'm Joanne Marr in San Quentin.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. According to ancient tradition, February 11, 660 BC is the date of the founding of Japan as a nation by the Emperor Jimmu. Many historians, though, deny the historical accuracy of that tradition. On this date in 55, Tiberius Claudius Caesar Britannicus, the 14-year-old son of the Emperor Claudius, died under mysterious circumstances in Rome amid palace intrigue over succession. Many believe he was murdered by his stepbrother Nero, who had grabbed the disputed throne just months earlier. In 1752, Pennsylvania Hospital was opened in Philadelphia. It was the first hospital in the United States. On this day in 1778, French Enlightenment philosopher Voltaire returned to a hero's welcome in Paris after living in exile in protest against what he saw as France's religious fanaticism. In 1943, Lieutenant General Dwight D. Eisenhower was promoted to full general and selected to command Allied forces in North Africa. In 1945, the three Allied leaders of World War II, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, concluded their critical wartime meeting at Yalta on the Crimean Peninsula. With victory close at hand, the men agreed on the unconditional surrender of Nazi Germany and post-war plans for its occupation, as well as Soviet help in the Pacific War against Japan. On this day in 1970, Japan successfully launched its first satellite into orbit around the Earth. The achievement made Japan the world's fourth space power. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The government of Venezuela continues to demonstrate a lack of respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms, attempting to stifle dissent by prosecuting political activists and cracking down on peaceful protests, in spite of repeated calls for change by the United States, other governments, respected leaders, and groups of experts. For this reason, the United States has announced more visa restrictions on an additional number of current and former Venezuelan government officials believed to be responsible for or complicit in human rights abuses. These restrictions will also affect the immediate family members of a number of those individuals subject to visa restrictions for believed involvement in human rights abuses or for acts of public corruption. Under the same section of law, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry imposed visa restrictions on persons considered to be responsible for acts of public corruption, which is contributing to the rapidly worsening economic and social conditions in Venezuela. Venezuela's economy is in dire straits, and the government's refusal to make any reforms is only making it worse. According to economists, inflation is now running at about 64%, the highest in Latin America. At the same time, Venezuela's oil revenues are being squeezed by sharply lower international oil prices. Indeed, everything from life-saving medicine and treatments to basic items like toilet paper are in short supply. The United States calls on the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to respect the rights to freedom of peaceful assembly and association and to release political prisoners. Until then, the United States, said State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki, is sending a clear message that human rights abusers from Venezuela, those who profit from public corruption, and their families are not welcome in the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.